I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. Another ruling is expected today from that same federal judge in San Diego who recently struck down the military's Don't Ask, Don't Tell policy as unconstitutional. The judge could now issue an injunction against the policy that prevents gays from serving openly in the military. But the Obama administration, which also wants to do away with Don't Ask, Don't Tell, wants Congress to settle this issue, not a judge. Elsewhere in Washington this week, Democrats decided to kick the vote on the Bush-era tax cuts down the road. And Stephen Colbert testified before Congress. Rick Klein is senior Washington editor for ABC World News and host of the political newscast Top Line. Rick, let's start with Don't Ask, Don't Tell. Harvard is also saying they may not allow recruiting back on campus while Don't Ask, Don't Tell is still in place. There was a vote in Congress this week, and the idea of allowing the president, voting to allow the president to remove it was defeated. So in other words, those against Don't Ask, Don't Tell lost on that issue. How much of an irritant is this for the White House that now this judge is thinking of weighing in?
This is as awkward as it comes for the White House. They're in a position of defending a policy that they're trying actively in the Congress to repeal. And it's something that gay rights activists don't quite understand and don't quite grasp and are very frustrated by with the White House. And obviously the president is on record on this. He has tried. He tried as recently as this week with the defense authorization bill to try to get the Don't Ask, Don't Tell repealed. And here you have judges who are stepping in and declaring it unconstitutional. The Obama administration has to defend a law it is on the record as not liking.
Because they wanted to go through the process at this point. There's a Pentagon review underway, and that's the avenue they want it to go through.
That's exactly right. And in fact, they weren't really pushing so much on the legislative front this week because they know that this has to wait for the military to come in. They don't want to see this as something that just was rammed through Congress. They want the military to go through this in a very deliberative process and then have Congress weigh in and get rid of this policy that they have the President Obama campaigned against.
Yeah. Well, more bleak economic news today. Sales of new homes had their second worst month on record last month. Factory orders for big ticket items fell by the largest amount in a year. Of course, all of these are, you know, tied to the slow jobs recovery. And yesterday, Democrats decided not to hold that vote before November on how to extend or if to extend or which to extend of the Bush-era tax cuts. It seems like they just neither party found a way to make this a win for them.
That's right. And it may be a worst-case scenario for Democrats because now Republicans can go into the fall saying, under Democratic rule, the largest tax increase in American history is about to take effect, even though everyone says the tax cut should be extended at least for those making less than $200,000 a year. The fact is the law on the books is going to say that everyone's taxes are going to go up as of January 1st. Yeah. Democrats had problems with their own caucus. They're blaming on Republicans, but the fact of the matter is they would have enough votes if the Democrats were on board, but you had enough moderate Democrats uncomfortable with any kind of tax increase to hold this up.
Yeah, we just want to touch on Stephen Colbert's appearance in Washington today. He testified before a House Immigration Committee in character, and for those, his character is sort of a conservative, very conservative a fellow, telling lawmakers he spent 10 hours picking fruits and vegetables as part of what is a real United Farm Workers campaign. It's called Take Our Jobs, Please. They invite unemployed Americans to do the work that's being done by immigrants. Here's what Colbert had to say about that.
It is really, really hard. For one thing, when you're picking beans, you have to spend all day bending over. It turns out, and I did not know this, most soil is at ground level. If we can put a man on the moon, why can't we make the earth waist high? Come on, where is the funding?
He also said that his doctors made him stop because he got a medical condition, a blister. Some people were angry about this, that they think it's a serious, and some lawmakers thought that, you know, it's a serious issue, shouldn't have a comic there. But others are thrilled that this issue is getting put back on the table.
Yeah, you know, you can argue it either way, and I was just struck by the fact that he stayed in character for most of his appearance, and you often see celebrities on the Hill, but John Hamm wouldn't testify as Don Draper, and that, I think, was extraordinary here. I think a lot of Democrats had mixed feelings about it, because you had an issue where, obviously this is a serious issue, to have a comedian being the front man for it, and the reason people are paying attention may not be the best of situations. Then again, this is the kind of hearing that I can guarantee you we wouldn't be playing clips from.
Exactly.
Yeah, if it didn't have Stephen Colbert in character.
Rick Klein, senior Washington editor for ABC World News, host of the political webcast Top Line. Rick, thank you.
Thank you.
Well, is this familiar?
To check the arrival or departure status for a flight today, please press 1.
It's become the engine of industry. It's something everyone depends on in one way or another, and it often doesn't work. We're talking about the call center-based customer service industry. Americans make over 43 billion customer service calls every year. That's over 1,000 every second. And remember this one? A guy named Vincent Ferrari trying to cancel his AOL service. It became a YouTube sensation.
What's the matter, Vincent? I mean, I'm just trying to help here.
You're not helping me. You're helping me with
the I am trying to
help. Helping me. Listen, I called to cancel the account. Helping me would be canceling the account. Please help me and cancel
it. No, I wouldn't, actually.
Well, journalist and author Emily Yellen decided to look deep into the belly of the beast of customer service in her 2009 book, Your Call Is Not That Important to Us, Customer Service and What It Reveals About Our World and Our Lives. It's just been reissued in paperback with an update entitled, Your Tweet Is Not That Important to Us. And we want to spend a few minutes with Emily today. She joins us from the studios of WKNO in Memphis, Tennessee. Emily, welcome.
I'm so glad to be here.
Who knew that a book on customer service could be such a riveting page turner, which it is. You know, there we are at a call center with you in Egypt. There we are in Salt Lake City, where JetBlue is hiring Mormons to answer phones out of their homes. We learn about the Helsinki Complaint Choir. Why? Why did you start this journey on customer service?
I was on hold, believe it or not. My furnace had gone out, and I was trying to talk to my home warranty company. And I was so angry. I was freezing. And I thought, somebody needs to look into this. And I started thinking about it and realized that this is something that everybody encounters in their daily lives. And almost across the board, everybody has a horror story.
Or something they've actually acted on. You have a chapter called Random Acts of Rudeness, some spectacular customer service gone wrong incidents. There's Mona Shaw in Manassas, Virginia. She and her husband tried to get help from Comcast. Technicians came and went. Her service was cut off. She drives to the office, is told to wait outside in the heat, and then, oh, sorry, everyone's gone home. She does what?
She goes and gets her husband's hammer and on Monday morning says, drive me back down there. She walks in the office, walks up to the desk of the woman who had blown her off on Friday and bangs her computer, her keyboard, and bashes it and says, now do I have your attention? There was a restraining order put on Mona.
Poor
Mona became kind of a hero of all the tormented customers of Comcast who had had such problems.
Well, and look, first of all, we're saying don't try this at home. And we're also going to hear what it's like to be on the other side of customer service, not the customer, but the one trying to give the service. But there was birthed a whole movement. Comcast must die. One of its leaders, NPR host Bob Garfield, he says he doesn't want the company to die. Just know what customers are going through. He has a video on his website, The Five Stages of Comcast. Let's listen.
They say you go through five stages.
No.
Denial.
No. This can't be happening.
Anger.
You are not helping me! Ah!
Bargaining.
Just give me a sign that someone's listening. Just one sign that someone's there.
Depression.
Thanks for holding. Your call is important to us. A customer service representative.
But acceptance?
Or my dead body.
Comcast responded.
They did. They then brought in people to monitor the internet for any mentions of Comcast and went on Twitter and various places and tried to help. And they were empowered to help in ways that customer service agents really should be. And that initiative actually changed the attitude at Comcast in general. More than ads or anything, customer service is their marketing now.
Well, and we don't have time. I mean, there's so much history here, which you go into, of sort of the attitude towards customers in American companies. And there was a time where the customer was first and right. But then suddenly we find ourselves, you know, with Lily Tomlin's character when you've got the Ma Bell conglomerate and, you know, she's saying things like, we're the phone company.
Right,
we don't have
right.
to care.
Right.
But then that started to shift. You've got General Electric opening its GE Answer Center in 1981.
Customer service as we know it now really started when 800 numbers and desktop computers merged, and we were able to have call centers. And suddenly companies realized that it was more efficient to answer their phones all in one place and have people trained just to do that. Plus, people didn't have to pay for 800 numbers. So that sort of became the standard. So that's how call centers evolved, and they kind of evolved from the receptionist. And that was the status that they had within companies. But as time has moved on and as technology has become much more prevalent, and certainly with cell phones and definitely with the internet, that function has become much, much, much more prominent. And a lot of companies haven't caught up. The technology is there. A lot of the knowledge of what we like and what works and what doesn't work is there. What's not there is the attitude and the understanding on the part of senior management that this is an area where you can really have an impact and differentiate yourself from your competitors, and an area to invest in, because if you do, the payoff is so great.
Well, in particular because we arrive at the age of the internet and Twitter and Facebook and YouTube. We talk about Vincent, you know, trying to get out of his AOL account. That led to sites like PayPalSucks.com, AllstateInsuranceSucks.com, MicrosoftSucks.org, IHateStarbucks.com, I hate Dell, Verizon Pathetic. What's been the role of these websites?
Well, before social networking, the web became a place where people started to vent their frustration. And pretty much if you put any company's name in Google with the word sucks after it, you can find something. And that was what started this. And then when Facebook and especially Twitter came along, suddenly other people would chime in, and then it would become a chorus, and then it would become even more a revolution almost, where customers suddenly had a voice like they never had before. And that is, for those of us who are customers, very exciting. For companies, it's a huge challenge.
Right. Well, you say you suddenly have a chorus. You literally had choirs. Tell us about the Helsinki Complaint Choir. Let's just listen to it a little bit. That's in Finnish, of course. We understand that they're complaining, I think, about toilet paper, the lack of toilet paper in bathrooms. But that led to the genre of complaint choirs. Let's listen to the Chicago Complaint Choir.
I started thinking, what is it that we do when we're complaining? Why are we complaining? So I started looking into the nature of complaining, and I came across something called the Complaints Choir, and it did start in Finland, and I liked that when they came to America, the founders of the Complaints Choir said, we wanted to come to America to fight the tyranny of the positive attitude in America, because their real attitude is that it's healthy to complain, it's healthy to say what's wrong and get it out and sing, and that when you do it in a chorus, it becomes kind of a catharsis for the people doing it and the people listening.
Well, and you say that there are companies that understand this. Zappos, the online shoe store, on their automated line, you can press 5 for the joke of the day.
Hi, I'm Zach, master of WoW.
Hi, I'm Joe.
Joe, how do you make a milkshake?
I don't know, Zach. How do you make a milkshake?
You give it a good scare.
When we come back, more with reporter Emily Yellen on customer service, including Amtrak Julie, here and now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, dedicated to accelerating the pace of discovery in engineering and science worldwide. On the web at mathworks.com.
Welcome back. We're speaking with journalist Emily Yellen. Her book, Your Call Is Not That Important to Us, has been reissued with an update on social media like Twitter. Emily traveled the world. She actually tracked down an Argentinian named Pablo, who was on the other end of one of her customer calls. She found sleek call centers in Egypt, in northern England, where call centers are replacing coal mines. Also found companies are bringing call centers home to make them the front line of marketing. And she concludes, we now have more automated centers than ever, but interestingly, less human contact. So, Emily, for instance, there's Amtrak Julie, who answers 18 million calls a year, more per day than a human could handle in an entire year. So tell us about Amtrak Julie.
I ended up visiting a place that produces these automatic voice response systems, ended up talking to an actress who does this voice for Julie. And Amtrak really had an idea that they wanted an automated agent for answering their calls, and they thought that maybe it was a way they could save money, but also it was a way that they could handle the incoming calls quickly and efficiently. And when I spoke to the actress, her name is also Julie, and she's based in Boston.
Julie Steinford.
Right. She's very famous for saying, "Got it." And she has some pretty strong views herself. One thing she said to me was, the customer is always right, and I'm always wrong with an automated agent. It's always, "Oh, I'm sorry." Amtrak Julie was a standard for a long time of how to do this right. And what we hate so much is when it's done wrong.
Well, let's remind people of what Julie sounds like.
To check if a particular train is running on time, say train status. Or to get schedule and price information, say schedules.
And Julie also became the subject of a Saturday Night Live skit, I think actually more than one. Here she is, Amtrak Julie with Antonio Banderas.
What do you do, Julie?
I do voice recordings for various customer service lines such as American Airlines and Amtrak.
Wow. I'm a CPA. I know. Boring, you know?
That's right.
No, but at this time over here. Busy.
I think you said dizzy. Did I get that right?
No. Busy.
I think you said Lizzie.
No, busy.
My mistake.
Well, you found that there's, you know, real serious study of this, the psychology of dealing with voice systems. When you think about voice systems having to understand what we say as well, the science behind that, you write, a voice system has to know the difference between someone saying, "Angelina Jolie is the bomb," and "I'm going to bomb Angelina Jolie." I mean, you know, this is something that top scientists are working on.
Right. And it's all about artificial intelligence. Artificial intelligence is what runs these automated voice systems. And anyone will tell you that artificial intelligence is not as smart as a human being yet.
Well, yet. And that reminds me of an anecdote you tell about IKEA Anna. She's the voice of IKEA. If you get frustrated with her and you start typing things in like, "This is frustrating," if this is online, she'll say, "I can't discuss these sorts of feelings or emotions. Please talk to me about IKEA." Yeah. Well, that's the automated customer service. Let's talk about the people who are on the other side, because you met them. There are 2.2 million customer service reps in the U.S. The highest concentration of service workers is in Sioux Falls, South Dakota, Lubbock, Texas, Jacksonville, Florida, Salt Lake City. Mormons who are working out of their home for JetBlue, part of another trend, call center workers actually in their own home.
Right. It's called home sourcing, and that's becoming quite a trend. And one of the advantages is that generally the people who work from home are older, they're more mature, they might have more education. For them, it's a great deal because the stress of commuting and going into an office is not there. And so you find happier workers. That was really interesting to see how they are handling, mostly people from the East and West Coast. One of the women I sat with, I asked her what she thought of the people who fly on JetBlue. She said, they don't have a lot of margins in their lives. Everything is scheduled very tightly. And so if something goes wrong, if there's a delay, they get so upset. And I thought that was a really interesting observation. It kind of speaks to something I found all over. I went to 4 continents. I went all over the United States, and I've spoken to customers. I've spoken to CEOs and everyone in between. And I think that customer service really is a crossroads of our culture, and it's both a reflection of and influences the way that we treat each other in public. And so the fact that people are rude when they are calling customer service, or we feel that the agents on the other end of the line are rude, that ends up having an effect on how we think of people in the world and how we treat each other.
Well, and one reason that people mistreat people in call centers is that they resent them. We know all about this, that there's a sense that in India, Guatemala, they've taken American jobs away. Somebody wrote an article called, "I Made an Indian Girl Cry and You Can Too," and people tried to do that. They got onto call centers with people in India and were beyond rude. And in fact, you remind us that call centers have sort of started moving away from India. They're not as interested anymore in working in call centers.
Right. India sort of set the standard, and now Indians have kind of had it with Americans and actually people from Britain and other places they've answered the phones for. That first iteration of outsourcing was maybe not done as skillfully as it could have been. But I think one of the things that happens to us when we call customer service and have a bad experience is we suffer from something which I don't want to make light of because it's a very serious issue. But on some level, I would say it's post-traumatic stress. We sometimes can get more angry at someone we speak to in customer service than someone we know very well. I think we feel helpless as customers, and that takes away your dignity. If a call gets to the point where the agent and the customer are at odds, it's really neither of their faults. It's really the fault of the company for putting those two people in that position. I think we need to all step back and recognize we've got all these machines, we've got to pay attention to the money, but we can't lose the humanity. We just can't lose that, and that's something that I've really seen and kind of become a crusader for now when I've looked at customer service and its importance in our lives.
That's Emily Yellen. Her book is Your Call Is Not That Important to Us, Customer Service and What It Reveals About Our World and Our Lives. Emily, thanks so much.
It's been a pleasure.
Baseball's regular season is winding down. Teams vying for pennant spots or a wild card. But for the first time in 43 years, another chase is on. The pursuit of one of baseball's most elusive prizes, the Triple Crown. To win it, you have to lead your league in batting average, runs batted in, and home runs. No one has done that since Boston Red Sox outfielder Carl Yastrzemski in 1967.
In the seventh inning, Carl Yastrzemski blasts a three-run homer to give the Red Sox victory, 6-4. Yaz ultimately winds up with a triple crown in batting.
Glenn Stout is with us. He's editor of the series Best American Sports Writing. Glenn, put this in perspective. What were Yaz's stats, the ones that got him that triple crown?
Well, in 1967, along with leading the Red Sox to an unexpected pennant and an appearance in the World Series, Carl Yastrzemski hit .326, which led the American League. He cracked 44 home runs and 121 RBIs, and that was enough to give Yastrzemski the Triple Crown.
Look, Yaz has a particular place in our hearts because we're here in Boston, but was it because he was so good that this hasn't been duplicated since, or has baseball gotten harder or something?
Well, he was very, very good in 1967. There's no question about that. But one of the main reasons I think that no one has had a triple crown since then is that with expansion, there are many more teams in baseball. And because you have more teams, that means you have more players competing in each of those three categories.
And who are the two players that are coming close?
Well, right now, it looks like Carlos Gonzalez, who's an outfielder with the Colorado Rockies, and Joey Votto, the first baseman of the Cincinnati Reds, both of them have an outside chance to win the Triple Crown in the National League.
We understand there were also some other players, but they sort of faded away in the end?
Right. Until recently, Albert Pujols in the National League also looked like he had a chance. His batting average has dropped down. And in the American League, about a month ago, Josh Hamilton, the outfielder of the Texas Rangers, looked like he had a real good chance to win the Triple Crown in the American League. But Josh Hamilton fractured some ribs, and he hasn't played for a while. And in the meantime, Bautista, the outfielder with the Toronto Blue Jays, has opened up a wide lead in the home run race. So no one's going to win the Triple Crown in the American League. It's just down to Gonzalez and Votto in the National League.
Well, and another reason that, you know, this may be so hard to do for players. How many players have done it in all of baseball?
There have only been 13 Triple Crown winners. Right. Since 1900. Now, a couple of times a player won that twice, namely Rogers Hornsby in 1922 and 1925, and Boston's own Ted Williams in 1942 and 1947.
Well, and I was going to say another reason that it might be so hard to, in modern times, for players to do it is that there's so much coverage now of baseball. They're so aware of it. Do they say that, you know, it makes it harder because you can choke?
The good thing that both Gonzalez and Votto have going for them is that their teams are fighting for division championships, and that has tended to keep the Triple Crown chase in the background. Mm-hmm. Now, the Reds have almost clinched, so I suggest that the closer the Reds get to clinching, or if they do clinch, then people might be questioning Joey Votto a lot more. Right now, I think he's probably happy to be flying under the radar a little bit.
Yeah, Joey Votto's quoted saying, this kind of stuff is embarrassing. You know, I'm shy. I just want to do my job. And Gonzalez says it's about what your team does. And Carl Yastrzemski said that after he won the Triple Crown in 67, he didn't even know it until he read about it in the papers next day. So he was able to sort of do it under the radar.
Well, right. And that also might tell us about Carl Yastrzemski's reading habits at the time, too. But
yes.
In 1967, you know, the Red Sox had captured the imagination of everyone, and everyone was focused on the pennant race. A Triple Crown was far, far down on the list of priorities that year.
Well, so there's the Triple Crown. Again, the last to win it, Carl Yastrzemski in 67. But then there's Joe DiMaggio's 56-game hitting streak. He got that in 1941. Which do you think of those two titles, which is going to be harder to duplicate?
Well, I think I'll side with the late Stephen Jay Gould on this one.
That's the late, great Harvard paleontologist.
Correct. He analyzed DiMaggio's hitting streak and concluded it was the most difficult feat in sports. I think I'll see someone in my lifetime win another Triple Crown. I don't think I'll see anybody hit in 56 straight games.
That's sports writer Glenn Stout, editor of the Best American Sports Writing Series. His new book, Fenway 1912, Fenway's first season, will be out next year. Glenn, we look forward to it. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
It's been a week of intrigue at the UN. Yesterday, Iran's President Ahmadinejad caused a walkout when he said 9/11 was an American plot to prop up Israel. Looking ahead, today's speakers before the General Assembly include the leaders of Japan, Haiti, Zimbabwe, and Rwanda. And President Obama is scheduled to take part in a special briefing on the future of Sudan, as that East African nation plans a referendum in about 4 months. The southern, largely animist and Christian region of Sudan is scheduled to decide whether to secede from the Muslim-dominated north, just 5 years after both sides officially ended more than two decades of civil war. Peter Gresta is following the developments in Sudan and at the UN. He's East African correspondent for the BBC, and he joins us now from Nairobi, Kenya. Peter, as we understand it, the referendum is part of the 2005 peace agreement. So take us back. Give us a quick summary of what's led to this point. What's at stake?
This is an absolutely critical referendum which is due to take place early in January next year. It was, as you say, part of the comprehensive peace accord that ended the civil war that lasted off and on for about two decades and killed some 2 million people. A lot of people have described it as a conflict between the Muslim North and the Christian South, which I think is a little bit inaccurate. In fact, it was a war over resources, the massive oil resources that are largely in the South, but also political resources. Khartoum has dominated Sudan's politics and gave very little political power and autonomy to the South, and it really was a rebellion against both the North's holding of both political and economic resources that led to the crisis. The Comprehensive Peace Accord gave the South an opportunity to vote for independence, to vote for secession, and that's really what's coming up early in January. Now, because the South has so much resources, and in particular oil, Khartoum has often been regarded as spoiling the vote. It seems the Khartoum really probably doesn't want the vote, although they have said that they will respect the outcome of the vote. Either way, this is what's critical. If the vote doesn't take place on time, the South has threatened to declare unilateral independence. If that happens, we are likely to see a very, very serious conflict, if not another war, erupt between North and South, because there are so many issues that remain outstanding. There is still no clear indication of where the border between the North and the South is. We still don't have a voter registration process in place. We still don't have the kinds of protocols that will define the way that North and South behave after the referendum takes place. And frankly, most people believe the outcome of the referendum will be for independence. And the times that I've been to South Sudan, I've always been struck by just how vehemently the Southerners want to go it alone.
Well, you speak of the danger at hand. Secretary of State Hillary Clinton is calling the referendum a ticking time bomb. But just remind us, where does Darfur fit into this conflict? Because people think of Sudan, they think of Darfur.
Well, Darfur is, in fact, very closely related to the peace process between North and South. The Darfur conflict broke out roughly around the time that the Comprehensive Peace Accord between the North and South was being finalized. And most analysts believe that it really was a rebellion by the Darfuris, by the African tribes in Darfur, to break away from Khartoum because they wanted something similar. They wanted also a degree of political and economic autonomy from Khartoum. And I think that's one of the fundamental issues when it comes to thinking about Sudan, that this is such a massive country with so many disparate tribes, with so many disparate interests right across the country, that it really is going to be very difficult for the country to hold together if South Sudan breaks away. And that's one of the big issues that so many of these diplomats have been trying to address in the past week, in the past few months.
Well, as you said, the president of Sudan is using delaying tactics to try to sabotage or undermine the vote. You also said that the preparations for the vote aren't even underway. You know, they haven't started registering voters. Meanwhile, the South has sort of a government in waiting, led by the Sudan's People Liberation Movement. What do you think is going to happen?
That's a very good question. At one level, I think that a new conflict is highly likely. The border is still not, hasn't been fully demarcated. The disputed oil-rich territories still haven't been defined. We still don't know whether they'll go to the north or the south. The agreements over revenue sharing of those oil resources still haven't been finalized. The issue of debt, who carries the debt that Sudan collectively owes, hasn't been finalized. There are so many fundamental issues that remain outstanding that have to be dealt with before the referendum takes place. Otherwise, we are going to see some very, very bitter disputes between the two regions. It is almost inevitable, I think, that the South will vote for independence. There is a very strong movement in the North that doesn't want to see the South go. I don't think it's hard to say whether President al-Bashir is directly trying to frustrate the referendum, but I think it certainly seems from analyzing the evidence that the North is really dragging its feet on this. If we don't get a clean referendum, if we do get unilateral declaration of independence, then I think that we are likely to see some form of conflict. The one thing that a number of diplomats have been pointing out, though, is that neither Khartoum nor Juba in the south really want another war. Nobody wants to go back to the kind of conflict that we saw that led to this peace accord. It was one of Africa's nastiest and most brutal and longest-running civil wars. It's still very much in people's memories. It is still very, very fresh. The problem is that it might not be possible to stop a conflict if, in fact, we see an escalating tensions between the two sides as a result of the kinds of outstanding issues.
And how important is President Obama's role in this?
Well, I think it's important up to a point. The Comprehensive Peace Agreement was seen as a major diplomatic victory for the Bush administration. It put enormous amounts of diplomatic and political energy into the negotiations. It threatened a lot of sanctions, which people say helped bring Khartoum to the table. But I think those sanctions really are limited. And the one thing, or one of the biggest issues that Khartoum is worried about, is the International Criminal Court's indictment for the president, Omar al-Bashir. He's wanted on war crimes charges, on charges of genocide for what's taken place in Darfur. Now, of course, President Obama has no real leverage over the International Criminal Court, and so it's going to be very difficult for him to deal with that very pressing concern. That's not to say he doesn't have any diplomatic leverage. I think that there is a lot that he can do. There are sanctions, there are other forms of diplomatic pressure that can be applied. But remember, since the Comprehensive Peace Accord took place, Sudan has moved in other directions, particularly economically. It's doing a lot of trade, a lot of business with China, and China is far less inclined to apply those kinds of diplomatic and political levers the U.S. has at its disposal. I think President Obama has a lot less leverage than President Bush had 5 years ago.
Peter Gresta, East Africa correspondent for the BBC, thank you.
Thanks very much. Always a pleasure.
A deaf radio show. We know, it sounds like a bad joke, but it actually has a lot of good jokes because the host, Keith Wan, happens to also be a comedian who developed his stand-up act by mining his life as the hearing child of deaf parents. Now, normally this is where we'd play a clip from one of Keith's many stand-up shows, but that's tough to do because he performs in American Sign Language, or ASL, and in fact jokes that English is his second language. And now, just last month, he launched That Keith Wan Show, Cultural Bridges, on Toganet Internet Radio. And this is a radio show where they talk about issues important to the deaf community. Since it's online, they also provide videos of the show interpreted with American Sign Language. Keith Wan joins us now. Welcome.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
Well, boy, some of the things that you joke about in your stand-up act, do your parents know?
They do. My parents are divorced, but they did go to a show of mine 3 years ago, and it was the first time they were both in a room together after 17 years. They were sitting in the front row, and as I got into a couple of my stories, and of course, as you know, all comedians, we exaggerate the truth. My mom started to stand up because she was embarrassed that I might have been lying to the audience. She started to wave and try to get my attention, saying, "That's not true." And then she stopped, sat down, looked at my dad and said, yeah, you remember that? Yeah.
But now let me ask you, so your parents are deaf. Was she signing when she did that? I mean, is it sort of quiet in the room when you do your stand-up act because you're signing?
It's my mom was signing. Both my parents sign. They don't speak for themselves. There's been times where I'm performing and the interpreter who cannot see behind them thinks I'm dying. Deaf people don't tend to make as much noises when they're watching a show because growing up, they were made fun of for whatever reasons. Look at you, you made a weird noise. So they've learned to keep it in. But you look at their faces, and I'm looking at the sea of smiling, laughing, crying faces. It's just, it's on their face. It's on their body.
Yeah. So, you know, you're not dying as a comic up there. You're going over well.
Absolutely.
You're killing.
I'm killing them.
Well, how much of this is true? For instance, one of the jokes you tell, did you really secretly unplug your mother's vacuum and allow her to continue to sweep, but she couldn't hear?
The first part is true. The second part is the exaggeration. Of course, a lot of CODAs, which stands for Child of Deaf Adults, it's a cultural identity for us. And a lot of times we don't really understand, what do you mean you're deaf? What do you mean you can't hear me? I thought you were just ignoring me for the first 8 years of my life. So we tend to want to do things to test them to see if they're really deaf. You know, maybe we will cover our mouths and say a couple choice words that any other parent after hearing would ground you for a week. And so the vacuum cleaner, that is a story that I do, but every single CODA out there has always come up to me and said, I've done that too.
Well, how about when you had to be the interpreter for your teachers with your parents, and if your teacher called a meeting to inform your parents how bad your grades are, you would actually sign, what a terrific kid you were.
Yeah, and as you start learning, as sign language, it's its own language, you start learning there's things that go along with it. So sign language has a facial grammar, which I wasn't aware of. So in the fourth grade, I was sitting between my mom and the teacher had a scowl on her face. She was very upset. Her body was tense. And she was saying, tell your mom you're terrible. You don't do your homework. You set the classroom on fire, anything, you know, things like that. I looked at my mom. I smiled and said, she says I'm an angel. My mom looked at my smile, looked at the teacher's face and said, son, you're fired. Get out of here. Let's get a real interpreter.
She knew. Well, and so what do you want to bring to a radio show for the deaf community?
I want to bring what we discuss in the ASL world, in the deaf world, I want to bring it to the hearing audiences. I want them to become aware of what we're talking about, especially as a sign language interpreter part-time. When I go to places, a lot of employers are not familiar with things like the Americans with Disabilities Act, which was passed 20 years ago, and it's their legal responsibility to provide interpreters for my parents who might need to go to a doctor's appointment, who might need to go to a real estate meeting to sign the papers. Those places have to provide interpreters. So I want to start having these kind of discussions and the hearing audiences hear that and start realizing, oh, this is what I need to do. They start hearing the terms that we're using.
Yeah. And you say, you know, you get asked a lot of really stupid questions by people about what it's like to be deaf. And then there are also simple miscommunications. So what are some of the questions? And then an example of a miscommunication, I'm thinking of a police officer.
Okay.
Thinking he's signing for a driver's license.
So a lot of times you do have police officers who, for whatever reason, maybe their commander says, hey, everybody, we need to know some sign language. And sometimes when you just know a little language, you can get in more trouble. And so this happened to my dad, and the officer knew a little bit of sign language. He did the sign, which he thought was for license. He did the L hand shape, which you now see in the Glee commercial. It's the L.
Right.
He did those two things. And instead of touching the thumbs, he touched the thumb and the index fingers together, which means, show me your female anatomy. My dad was shocked. The number one question is, how do deaf people eat? And then how do they have sex? By then, I'm done with it. I'm done with this person. So I give him the answer. Deaf people have sex just like they eat, sloppy and loud.
You tell very funny stories about having deaf parents, but also I'm sure there were serious issues that you had to deal with. I mean, I'm reading, and maybe you meant this as a joke, but I'm reading that, you know, your parents would put you to bed and think you were asleep, but you'd be crying.
It's a play on it, but yes. And I talked to my mom about this. She says, you were a good kid. You slept all the time. Mm-hmm. I'm thinking, no, I didn't. You never heard me.
Yeah.
No. I want to make sure we get this out there, that because there have been some questions coming up. Can deaf people raise hearing children? Absolutely. Absolutely.
We understand there are huge divides in the deaf community. whether or not a child should get a cochlear implant and learn how to hear, if in fact the parents are deaf, whether or not they should sign or learn to speak.
It's very ironic right now. If you and I, as hearing parents, have a hearing child, one of the number one selling DVDs out there is called Signing Babies. They have all these programs to teach hearing babies sign language because there's been research that it helps develop language. There's been research that it helps them through the terrible twos because they're able to ask for what they want. Where on the other hand, like you just said, we have doctors telling these parents, don't let your deaf child learn sign language. This is ridiculous. We're allowing to teach the hearing children, but not the deaf children. With cochlear implant, again, that is a heated discussion. I'm not that parent. That's a hard decision for them to make. But I do say, please teach your child sign language.
You do a lot of things that, you know, again, only someone with entree probably into a community can do. For instance, I guess there's a discussion within the deaf community about whether or not women are too dramatic when they sign.
Yes. Female students tend to be more expressive. They get into it. We're guys, you know, we're cool. We're hearing guys. We don't do this kind of stuff. We don't make faces. There's times where I also make fun of that, and I'll show on stage what a female signer will look like and a male signer will look like when they're doing two different songs.
Well, you have the female doing Total Eclipse of the Heart, in which she literally spins around so often that she gets sick.
She gets stuck on the lyrics, turn around, and she can never get to the rest of the song.
You can hear That Keith Wan Show, Cultural Bridges, Wednesdays from 8 to 9 p.m. Eastern Time on the Toginet Talk Radio Network. For more on that and Keith's tour dates, go to hearnow.org. Keith, thanks so much.
Thank you very much.
Because we'll never be wrong.